It's a couple of minutes after 9 o'clock at 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Where for this next hour of programming, the opinions and views expressed are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. Time now for Talking Animals on KUCI. That's new music from Paul Weller with his version of Neil Young's Birds as we slide into today's edition of Talking Animals on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Streaming live, of course, on the internet at KUCI.org. And the whole enterprise, the whole shebang, the whole enchilada, the whole nine yards is broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'll be with you till 10 o'clock this morning with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. Right off the bat, I'd like to tell you for the next hour, you can reach us directly by phone at 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI, and I absolutely urge you to use that number. Call us at any point in the show. Don't be shy. Only we love to get calls. You can also instant message us via AOL Instant Messenger. Screen name, not surprisingly perhaps, is Talking Animals. And other ways to be in touch, though less immediately, include emailing us at talkinganimals@AOL.com and checking out our website, talkinganimals.net. Again, don't forget, that's .net, folks. Also, before we move on, I want to thank Serena Sharp for another stirring session of the Serena Sharp Show. We love alliteration here at Talking Animals. Meanwhile, here at Talking Animals, we primarily strive to learn about animals and animal issues from our guests, from news items, from your calls, from assorted other sources, but also each week to celebrate animals through music, comedy, and other means. We aim for a spirited balance of those elements. You can readily glean by visiting our nifty website, again, talkinganimals.net, where nearly every show we've ever broadcast is archived. We're a little behind, but we're getting cut up this week, I'm confident. Clearly the heart of the program is the interview we conduct each week with some notable inhabitant of some province of the animal world. Today, happy Columbus Day, and not entirely coincidentally, our guest is another ocean-going explorer of sorts, Dennis Kelly, longtime professor of marine science at Orange Coast College. He's been at the school since 1974, and with a special interest and expertise in bottlenose dolphins. He's also chair of the Marine Science Department, director of the Orange Coast College Public Aquarium, and director of the Coast Dolphin Survey Project. So we'll learn all about that project and lots more about bottlenose dolphins. Who knows what else we might squeeze in when Dennis Kelly joins us in a few minutes here on Talking Animals. And actually today, I mean literally joins us in an all-too-rare occurrence. He's in studio with us, so we're excited about that. Dennis, let's welcome you right now. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Duncan. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's so great. I mean, even people who are fairly local, we usually have to speak with them on the phone, which I understand. It's Monday morning. People are busy, so it's so great that you came in person. So hopefully you'll chime in a little bit on the news and then a little step into the comedy corner, and then we'll get to you talk about dolphins and any number of other things. So it is time for our weekly look at items of interest in animal news. And I want to remind you of the phone number one more time to join us on the show with your own comments and questions about animals. Not only this week's animal news items, but also any other animal topic you'd care to discuss. Announcements, if you have a benefit, fundraiser coming up, observations. Of course, any news stories you might have spotted. Dennis actually just mentioned one to me that I hadn't seen that we're going to follow up. So they all be most welcome. Phone number is 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI. So turning now to interesting or important developments recently in animal news. Typically these are local, regional, national, occasionally international animal stories of note that seem important to spotlight. And with any luck to get your comments on and discuss. We also try to include a few announcements of upcoming events or activities that you may want to pencil in on your calendar. So having said that, wait for it. All right, let's talk turkey, as it were. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. I guess, gruesome as it is, we almost have to start with a local and awful story. Let's just get into the headlines so we know where we're heading with this. Dog beheading case illustrates Prop 66 battle. The subheadline, a La Habra man with a violent past gets 25 years to life for the crime. If voters revise the state's three-strikes law, he'll be released within months. And the story itself, I took from the LA Times, by the way, starts off, prosecutors say James Andrew Abernathy once forced his sister to play Russian roulette. He has stabbed two men. And 6 years ago, they say, police stopped him in his car with a samurai sword that he was planning to use on his ex-wife's new husband. Reflecting on this history of violence, an Orange County judge on Friday used the state's three-strikes law to give Abernathy, 43, a heavy sentence for the relatively lesser crime of animal cruelty. Convicted of beheading his dog, and despite a girlfriend, Abernathy is to spend 25 years to life in prison. But if state voters approve a November 2nd ballot measure that amends the three-strikes law, he will be released soon after the new law takes effect January 1. Orange County prosecutors and other Proposition 66 opponents So the case shows what's wrong with the measure. If passed, hundreds of convicts, such as Abernathy, will be free. Quote, terrorizing people and animals is his form of entertainment, said Deputy District Attorney Heather Brown. Other than the three strikes law was designed to protect the community from people like him, but one supporter of the measure said the case illustrates why the law needs to be changed. Quote, no one has ever said that 25 years to life is a suitable punishment for animal cruelty, said Michael Vitiello, a professor at the McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento, who has given legal advice to the Proposition 66 campaign. If we're punishing for the past, that's double jeopardy. Well, the story goes on from there. I mean, it's tricky because it may or may not be the best test case for this proposition about the three strikes law. But on the other hand, I think when you went on to get into all the gruesome details of what this guy did to his dog, but I mean, beheading, I think, covers it. You know, I would hope that you wouldn't be released if that proposition passed regardless. I mean, it seems like there's some sort of punishment that should be in there. Anyways, your thoughts, your comments, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI. Even more locally, this is getting, to me at least, increasingly disturbing. I took this from the Daily Pilot, actually. Former shelter volunteer files complaint. And we talked about this last week on Talking Animals. I'll just read a little bit of the pilot story. A former volunteer at a Huntington Beach animal shelter has filed a complaint with the state veterinary medical board alleging that the veterinarian who owns the shelter uses unlicensed technicians to euthanize and perform surgical procedures on animals at his adjoining hospital. In her complaint, filed against AAA Animal Hospital and the Orange County Humane Society, both on Newland Street, Shelley Hunter states that she is addressing the illegal, inhumane, and unethical practices, end quote, taking place at the shelter and the hospital. The shelter has contracts with the cities of Costa Mesa and Westminster to impound and care for their stray animals. Samir Botros, the veterinarian and shelter owner, has consistently denied the allegations. On Wednesday, he said the complaints filed September 15th was yet another attempt by former volunteers to wage a personal battle against them. Quote, if you come to my place and tell me how to run it and I ask you to leave, you're not going to be happy, said. The fact that these people are attacking my business straight away shows that this is personal. Well, anyway, again, it goes on from there. We don't have time to read the whole story, of course, but I mean, something's going on there, because as we talked about last week, at the end of August, Mr. Botros fired, if you can fire volunteers, anyways, he fired or released all the volunteers, and a number of them have weighed in, and there's been protests in front of the thing, and it's a pretty disturbing story, so we're going to follow this closely, but, I mean, we don't know what the situation is exactly, but there's at least smoke here, if not fire, and again, as a Costa Mesa resident, so therefore very directly involved with, I guess, funding this operation, I want to make sure that these animals are being well cared for. So we'll keep posting that. If you have any thoughts, if you've been a volunteer there by any chance or know anything from the inside, give us a call, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. And Dennis, don't be shy. If you've got any thoughts or comments along the way, I'd love to...
So we're both appalling stories.
Aren't they? Yeah. So that's why we're moving into something much more upbeat. Not as local, but much more upbeat, which is that a baby giraffe was born recently at the L.A. Zoo. And kind of presents its own care challenges, because I guess the mother, for some reason, did not... I don't know that she rejected the baby, but I know that the zookeepers are sort of having to bottle feed her and kind of give her around-the-clock care. So not really much more to say.
Wasn't there something in that story about when the baby's born, he drops like 6 or 7 feet?
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, part of, yeah, just being a baby giraffe, and which always just seems, I mean, astounding that they survived that, you know?
What a welcome to the world.
Yeah, boy, that's a rough entry. But I guess the little baby is otherwise doing well, and they think everything's going to be fine. It's just they're really, I guess, being very very careful about his care initially, since I guess the mother hasn't been as directly involved. But anyway, it's kind of cool. There's a cool picture, at least in this one of the stories that ran with that, of the giraffe sort of looking over the fence at someone about to give him a nice bottle of milk. And then another zoo story, kind of a little different deal. This is from the San Diego Zoo, where a tiger there that... had a life-threatening toothache. It was anesthetized, and they removed and moved some of the teeth. But the other thing, which I think gets into a whole different issue altogether, is, in fact, as the story says also from the LA Times, as the nether region of the sleeping animal, at the nether region of the sleeping animal, another team of specialists was accomplishing another chore, removing sperm for the, quote, frozen zoo, the institution's project to store sperm and eggs from endangered animals for possible use in reproductive efforts to stave off extinction. Barbara Durant, the zoo's reproductive specialist, examined a Wang Relax, that's the name of the tiger, sperm under a microscope. It's fair stuff, she said. He doesn't have a high count, but he's young. So, yeah, I mean, that, like I say, takes us in a whole other realm. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts or comments about that, but...
They used to call the place where they stored the sperm the Ark.
Oh, really? Yeah, well, that's somehow a little more appealing than the frozen zoo, but also I guess there's just something to ponder about the idea of removing sperm in this way to then obviously see what kind of reproductive efforts could be done when it's in a zoo setting. I mean, anyway. Again, any thoughts, comments, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI, or again, instant messages by way of AOL Instant Messenger screen name Talking Animals. It's time now. We're going to cut our news a little short so we can get chatting officially with Dennis a little more promptly. But we're going to do a couple more things, including our quick quiz that we do in the animal news each week. So this is a true-false question. And... it's not just a true-false question. You get a prize, obviously, if you're the first person who calls in with the correct answer. And some of those prizes include lint rollers, CDs and books from our past guests, including Ian Anderson and a woman who wrote this really great book called For Bee, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life, about a former laboratory beagle that she adopted and cared for. You have Shirley MacLaine's book. She has not been a guest yet, but as I've said many times... that's a prize primarily because her dog co-wrote the book with her, so you gotta like that. Let's see what else we have. We have some T-shirts from various animal organizations, including a PAWS T-shirt that says "Elephants Don't Belong in Circuses." We actually now have a Talking Animals T-shirt or a sweatshirt to give out possibly if someone wins this and/or name the animal tune later. We have safety collars, leashes, all kinds of cat toys. We have the new DVD by Triumph, the Insult Comic Dog. We've got a bunch of stuff. So you'll have your choice of that if you're the first person to correctly call in with this, or later when we get into Name That Animal Tune, if you're the first person to correctly identify that song. So here's our question for today. It's true, false, and Dennis, no cheating if you know. All 18 species of penguin are found below the equator, primarily in the Antarctic Circle. True or false? If you know that, it's 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. And we might have just time for one more plug. If we have time on the end of the show, we're going to get into some other... Well, let's see. I mean, this... looks like somebody's calling in. Hi, you're on the air live on KUCI.
I think it's false.
Okay, well, sadly, you had a 50-50 chance. And you're on the wrong side of that 50%. So,
okay, thank you.
Okay, well, that's it. You're okay, well, thanks for calling.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah. So all 18 species of penguin, unless you know differently, Dennis, but that according to what I have
just
here.
Just the ones at SeaWorld.
Okay, well, yeah. So, are found below the equator. So that was true. So, but thanks for calling, and we'd love people to at least call in and give a shot. We'd like to hear from people here at the Talking Animals. So... one more quick plug, and like I say, if we have time, and then we'll get back to some other news items later in the show, but this is really important. It's a website called the Animal Rescue Site, and if you go, every day basically you can go to the site. It's the Animal Rescue Site, SITE.com, and there's a little section there you can click on, Feed an Animal in Need, and if you do that, because of an arrangement with their corporate sponsors and advertisers, that releases funds to indeed feed or otherwise care for abandoned, neglected animals at various shelters and facilities. So please, please, please try to do that. Just make a note. Do that every day. And it's the animalrescuesite.com. So, as I say, if we have time later, we'll come back to some news. But meanwhile, if there are ever any news stories or announcements or events you'd like to bring to our attention, please feel free to email us those items at talkinganimals@AOL.com. We'd also love to encourage you to email us with comments about the show, suggestions of future guests, ideas about animal songs, comedy bits, any other animal topic that's on your mind. That email again is talkinganimals@AOL.com. And I'm pleased to remind you, perhaps redundantly, that about the Talking Animals website, which is talkinganimals.net. Again, that's .net, folks. And sign up for the email list if you can, so we'll keep you posted on upcoming guests and other announcements. You'll also find archives and synopses of just about every show we've ever broadcast, photographs, articles we've written, articles about the show, all kinds of links, other audio pieces, and more. So please stop by and take a look around the site. Again, it's talkinganimals.net. It's time now to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which, is always, of course, involves animal-oriented comedy. And but in a nod to our guest, Dennis Kelly, I thought today's offering should have a more aquatic bent. So this is Brian Regan with a piece called Whale Noises on today's Comedy Corner here at KUCI.
I saw this documentary recently on whales. This guy has dedicated his life to telling you what the whales are saying. Wow. I don't know how you'd argue with him when he turns in his report. And he just throws it down there. Well, here's what the whales are saying. Okay, thanks, Charlie. Just looking back. Here's what the whales are saying. Yeah, Charlie figured it out. They show how he does it. He's out on a ship. He's got a pencil, and he deciphers the whale noises as he hears them. You know, he'll hear like... He's like, oh, okay. Oh, he's lonely. No, you're lonely. I'd like to do that for like 2 weeks and then turn around and find out that the door's squeaking behind you.
All right, that's it. That's Brian Regan with Whale Noises from his album entitled Simply Live. The Comedy Corner is, of course, one of the signature features of Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're indeed listening to Talking Animals on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. As many of you know, we also stream live on the internet at KUCI.org. Some of you, no doubt, are listening that very way as we speak. And some of you, perhaps, arrived there through our small website, talkinganimals.net. Before we proceed, I'm obliged to remind you that the opinions and views expressed on Talking Animals are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California, Board of Regents. And earlier in the show, I mentioned this week's guest is Dennis Kelly, a longtime professor of marine science at Orange Coast College, whose particular area of study and expertise is bottlenose dolphins. So let's remind you of the phone number so you can join us in the conversation with questions for Dennis, if you'd like, with 949-824-5824, as we welcome Dennis Kelly to Talking Animals. Dennis, we've already welcomed you, but we're welcoming you again. That's just the kind of types we are.
Thanks very much.
So, obviously, today we, you know, primarily do want to discuss bottlenose dolphins, glorious creatures that you've studied closely for years. But before we dive into dolphins, as it were, it might be useful to establish some context. So let's learn a little bit about you, including the personal and academic path that brought you to becoming an acknowledged expert on these dolphins, among many other marine critters. So first of all, you're one of those rare Southern California natives, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Born and raised.
Wow. Yeah. And how much of that time in Orange County, and how much just
first 10 years were in? Well, I was born in Hollywood.
Okay.
And grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and then when I was about 10, we moved to Anaheim, and I've pretty much been in Orange County ever since.
Wow. And so growing up, were you always an animal guy, or more to the point, even a marine animal guy? Or?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
My mom's earliest story was I was collecting shells on the beach at Carpinteria State Beach, and my grandmother kept trying to talk me into putting them back in the water because they still had animals in them.
Mm.
And I insisted, you know, I'll change the water. I probably would have killed him because I would have put fresh water in there.
Right, yeah.
She talked me into it. So I've always had a special place for animals.
Wow, wow.
Especially ocean animals.
Yeah, sounds like it. And so really then by the tail end of high school or beginning of college, was it clear that since this has obviously been a passion since you were a kid, that you wanted to study, if not devote your life to animals where they live in the ocean?
Pretty much. Yeah. You know, I grew up watching the original Flipper shows.
Sure.
I read every book that Jacques Cousteau ever wrote. And by the time I was in high school, I was really interested in this as a possible career. The problem was that I kept being told by people that, well, you can never get a job in marine biology, and if you did, you wouldn't make any money. If you made money, it wouldn't be enough to support a family. But I'd been a Boy Scout, and I'd done some extraordinary things as a Boy Scout, and so I thought, well, maybe they don't know what they're talking about. Maybe I actually could do this.
I'll prove them wrong, sounds
absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely.
Yeah, cool. And so you did. So then take us through that. So because you mentioned you're a long time Orange County guy, how did you pursue kind of your post high school academic?
Well, I actually started in high school. I took a lot of biology in high school, went on to Thornton Community College, which I graduated from, and got really inspired by several teachers there. One in particular, Alan Schoner, Dr. Alan Schoner is still involved with Thornton College and has been an inspiration to me.
Wow.
Went on to Cal State Fullerton, earned my bachelor's degree, came back, earned my master's degree, and about the time, literally the month I was given my master's degree, I was hired by Orange Coast College to be a marine biology professor.
Wow.
And the nice thing about community college is you teach a little bit more than you would, say, at UC Irvine, but you don't teach as much as you would at, say, an elementary school or a high school. So you have some free time. And one of the people that hired me suggested, you know, if you want to do some research, there's time to do that here. You could have your summers off, Christmas is off, Easter vacation, things like that. And so I got started pretty early in my studies of dolphins. Like within 2 to 3 years, I was doing research on dolphins, and I started in 74. So, you know, from that time on, I've been studying dolphins constantly. And the nice thing is I had plenty of students that wanted to participate and learn about these animals.
Sure.
I never was out of students that wanted to go and
No, that's great, because it seems like it's a great experience for them, and it also just helps you, obviously, pursue that. So let me remind our listeners, this is Talking Animals on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. We're speaking with Dennis Kelly, longtime professor of marine science at Orange Coast College and an expert, longtime expert on bottlenose dolphins. And we'd love to have you join the conversation, calling us 949-824-5824, 949-UCI. KUCI, or if you're the shy type and you're listening online and you want to just IM us, that's fine. AOL Instant Messenger, the screen name is Talking Animals. So, well, let's back up for one sec, because one of the things as I was kind of gearing up to chat with you this morning is, if I'm not mistaken, your master's was, thesis at least, was in the reproductive ecology of sea squirts?
Yeah, sea squirts. They look like little withered cigars that have been floating in the water too long.
But are those some things that are kind of attached to docks or piers or whatever?
There's three types. One type lives their whole life attached to a dock or a pier.
Okay.
And they're filter feeders. One type drifts around in the ocean, sort of like plankton. And then there's one type that actually looks like a little fish. And some of us believe that they were what gave rise to the first fish.
Oh, wow.
So they're actually a very, very advanced animal trapped in a body that looks fairly primitive.
Huh. Interesting. So
the other reason I studied them is because they were right in the center between vertebrate and intervertebrate zoology.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know a lot of both when I was in college, and the invertebrate people tended to be just a bit spineless. And the invertebrate people were
I had sound effects for a rim shot, but I'm not equipped for that. So
the vertebrate people tended to be fairly assertive and aggressive.
Uh-huh.
So I found it was great to study tunicates, because they both would kind of identify with you. They'd say, oh, well, you study invertebrates. I'd say, well, yeah, technically they are invertebrates.
Wow.
But the vertebrate people say, oh, they have a notochord, so they're part of us, you know.
So you had a foot in both camps,
basically.
Absolutely. Oh, that's great. That's great. But it really does sound like, from what you said a moment ago, that almost from the get-go, at least getting to OCC, that it was sort of dolphin, right? I mean,
Right.
And really, I guess right around that time, or maybe that was sort of, you know, what launched it, is the Coastal Dolphin Survey Project. So maybe you could just tell us what that is, and you know, obviously it's been going a long time, but sort of what the focus was, and did you launch it with others, or what prompted it?
Well, I launched it with students.
Okay.
Students helped me get it started. And what it was an attempt to scientifically prove that a theory one of my students had was incorrect. I had a student named Mark Blake, and one day in class he raised his hand, and he hadn't really participated much in class, so I was pretty surprised. And he said, hey, what's the dolphins I see every day when I go surfing? And I go, every day you go surfing? Yeah, I surf down at Newport and these dolphins go by. And I was a surfer for a while myself, and I remember seeing dolphins, but I always thought they were dolphins that, you know, had just come by, checked out our coast, said, ooh, it's pretty crowded here, and took an off for Catalina or parts west. And so we began the project because I was thoroughly convinced this guy had seen some dolphins, but he really didn't know what he was talking about. And it turned out, as always, he knew exactly what he was talking about. So our first efforts were just simply to document whether these animals were resident to the coast of Orange County, and if so, how many there were, and what was the population distribution, how far north did they go, how far south, how many babies were born per year. And it sort of dovetailed into more and more and more. In fact, they, for a while, they kind of became a metaphor for the health or the condition of our coast.
Because
about the time I published one of my first big papers documenting their population size, the Orange County Sanitation District was going for their 301H waiver, which was an attempt to treat the sewage a little bit less, dump a little bit more. It saves money.
Mm-hmm.
And when my paper came out, it was kind of controversial because we had by then collected some dolphins off the beach, had analyzed them, had them analyzed at a laboratory, and they had phenomenal levels of DDT and PCBs in them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Orange County Sanitation District at the time, this is, you know, 30 years ago,
sure,
they really hadn't looked at those animals yet. And so that sort of got them a little bit upset.
Yeah.
They were saying, like, everything's fine, you know, everything, our studies indicate everything's good, and then this guy comes out and says, but the dolphins are so contaminated that when they're on the beach, they really qualify as toxic waste.
Oh, my God.
And they shouldn't even be buried there.
So what was the upshot? I mean, because that must have had a significant impact beyond just surprising them.
Well, I had a lot of meetings with them, and ultimately, I actually worked a project for them where we looked at more than just bottlenose dolphins, all the different dolphins and whales, and we realized that there was still DDT out there,
mm-hmm,
and they took that into account when they began redesigning their plant. And actually, what's interesting is I think they've solved that problem, that the DDT that was still coming out in the waste stream has stopped, and the levels in the dolphins have gone down, because there have been some animals recovered recently. When they were analyzed, their levels were far, far lower than they were 25, 30 years ago.
Huh, so it has gotten better, and at least partially, I'm guessing, related to your findings.
It appears to have gotten a lot better, and there were a lot more people involved with this than me. There were other people doing studies like that.
Sure.
I just happened to be here in Orange County.
Right, right, so you could be one of the squeakier wheels, though.
Well, one of the things that happened that was peculiar early on is I really thought this, when I discovered, after about 3 or 4 years of research, these animals are always here. There's always groups of dolphins along the coast, and I mean within less than a mile from shore, I mean,
mm-hmm,
outside the wave line. And if you follow them 24 hours or 48 hours, they're still here. They're just moving up down the coast. I always thought this would be an ideal project for a UCI professor, a
mm-hmm
long-term project. There just wasn't anybody that was interested in, so I kept doing it,
mm-hmm,
and kept adding to it. And ultimately, it became also an educational project, because if you make a lot of discoveries, and they're unique discoveries, it does no good just to publish them in the scientific literature. You got to get them out to the people,
yeah,
so that people can take these things into account when they make decisions. So
sure,
I ended up talking to a lot of newspapers, radio shows, television shows. We made a movie about them called Dolphins of the Orange Coast, and got the movie out there, a video documentary.
How long ago was that?
1985.
Okay.
And
it was still available somewhere?
Oh, yeah. It was very successful. It won the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, Gold Award.
Wow,
and it
great
won the Orange County Video Station Award. And we just basically gave it to all the local television stations, said, please show this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the result has been, now the dolphins are accepted as part of the family of animals and plants that live here. And when anything is done to their environment, they have to be taken into consideration in, like, the environmental impact statements. Now, sometimes they don't say anything. They just say, well, they're there, and on to the development. And sometimes
right,
they write mitigation things like, well,
yeah,
what more could we do so that their lives aren't damaged? For example, there were plans for development at Crystal Cove, big plants,
mm-hmm,
huge plants, thousands of homes. And that was pared down significantly. And I think, you know, part of the reason, a small part, was that not only do dolphins occur at Crystal Cove, but we've seen extraordinary behavior there. We've seen a behavior that I document and wrote a paper about called dolphin birthing circles, where the dolphins come in, and when they're getting ready to give birth, they'll form a circle around the female giving birth and sort of midwife her,
wow,
until the baby was born. And we saw that about 12 or 13 times there, and only a couple times anywhere else. And here's what's really amazing. Nowhere else documented on Earth yet, although there may have been some behaviors seen in Texas that were similar,
huh,
maybe a couple in Florida,
wow,
but a really unique behavior. And this was right at a site where originally they were planning to build thousands and thousands and thousands of homes.
Yeah.
And so that was pared down a little bit. And I think, you know, a little bit of the reason was because they took the dolphins into consideration.
And sorry, Dennis, the circle, the sort of midwifing, you know, sort of circle you described, was that specifically in that area, or have you seen that now, given all your years, a number of times
only
in other locations, or was it really...
A couple of other areas, but only a couple of times. Once at Three Arch Bay, which is just a few miles south in Laguna, twice at South San Onofre State Beach, and once at White's Point, which is up at Palos Verdes, and that's it.
And what do you think accounts for, then, that... You know, who knows how many other times it's gone on where you couldn't observe it. But, I mean, why isn't it more common? I mean, it sounds like it's almost a very kind of ritualized way to protect the mother that's giving birth.
One of the theories I've had about it is this always happens in very sheltered bays and little coves that aren't inhabited by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe other scientists aren't looking in the right places. For instance, there's a big project that's studied dolphins for longer than mine in Florida. But they study dolphins in Sarasota Bay, which is extremely inhabited.
Yeah.
And so there aren't any little sheltered coves. And so I think that's part of it.
Oh, sorry to interrupt, Dennis. Looks like we might have a call. And do you want to take a call?
Sure.
Okay, cool. Hi, you're on the air live on KUCI with Dennis Kelly talking about bottlenose dolphins.
Yes, I have a question for Dennis.
Great. Please go ahead.
Hello, Dennis. I'd like to ask you how you do your how you collect your data. In Florida, I've seen the divers go in with the manatees with a clipboard and goggles and that sort of thing. Is that the same process for when you're with dolphins? Are you in there swimming with them?
No, I've never actually done that. I decided early on that Heisenberg was right, and the more you interact with an animal, the more you potentially change its behavior. So we started from the beginning doing boat surveys, and we always conducted our boat surveys so that when we spotted dolphins, almost always 100% of the time, we spotted them from a long way off. So we'd stop the boat and watch them for quite a while with binoculars to try to find out what they were doing and not approach them. Sometimes, amazingly, the dolphins would approach us. They'd swim right up to the side of the boat. But I felt that's kind of a close encounter of the cetacean kind, and, you know, that's their decision. Most of our work today is done from cliff tops and beach sites. We don't go out with boats anymore, mainly because there's so many more people out there, and if you're in a boat close to shore, you're interacting with surfers and don't really want to do that. And they seem to behave more naturally if we do it that way. But I am familiar with the work in Florida, and the animals in Florida become accustomed to human divers. The problem we have here is the water is generally so cloudy that you could be within 4 feet of a dolphin and not know it.
I see. Well, that's very interesting, though. Thank you very much for letting me know that.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. And let me tell our listeners, too, that I'll get to this a couple more times as well, but as a website that has specific information about the Coastal Low Dolphin Survey, so it's antarctic.com/, and correct me on this, Dennis, if I get it wrong, /coastaldolphinsurvey.html.
That's correct.
That? Okay,
yeah,
cool.
That's correct.
All right, I move on to the next round. But anyways, it's really fascinating, and there's, I mean, we're going to talk more, of course, in our remaining time with Dennis, but there's a lot of great, papers and other elements of this that we probably aren't going to have time for, so I would really urge people to check out the site. So how would you say, I mean, 25 plus, I guess, years, how have the objectives of the project changed? I mean, in a way, you've cited some just by virtue of developments that came along that just by virtue of having the expertise that you had or the findings, you could kind of help stave off things But, I mean, are there specific research objectives that have evolved over that time?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Up until recently, our number one objective was to just keep documenting how many dolphins were along the coast and exactly where they were and what their behaviors were as development continues along the coast. But then in the last, say, 9 months, the most truly extraordinary things that have ever fallen into my lap have fallen into my lap. And you know, you kind of figure after 27 years you've pretty much done it all and they've shown you everything they were going to show you, and then out of nowhere they do something unexpected or something unusual happens. And so I'm busier right now than I've been
really?
For the last 27 years.
Yeah? And because I know one thing that seemed fairly new that sounds interesting too that you might be able to tell us a little bit about is the Night Watch project.
We started the Night Watch actually 4 years ago because I went to an elementary school and talked, and the first kid with his hand up said, "What do they do at night?" And I kind of hemmed and hawed for a while, and finally I admitted, well, I really don't know. And he said, well, aren't you the dolphin expert?
Wow, said, busted.
Yeah, busted yeah. big time.
Yeah.
So what I did is I organized a project, and we studied the dolphins from Crystal Cove, actually one of the old abandoned cottages there, 2 weekends in a row, a Friday, Saturday, 24 hours, 2 weekends in a row, using night vision equipment at night.
Hmm.
And my hypothesis was they would be totally different at night. They would act different numbers than they do during the day. And I was completely wrong. They act identical to the way they do during the day. It's almost like there's no nighttime out there. In fact, we've never seen them stop and sleep, what I would consider sleep. They'll slow down and rest once in a while, but no sleep like we sleep. And just moving around, fishing and hunting and things like that. And we saw quite a few dolphins while we did that project.
Really?
So at least I know now when some kid asks a
yeah.
question like that.
Wow. So it's really, there's no, sounds like, I mean, you could see the same dolphin at night or day and they would be the same activities,
right,
the same
right.
swimming.
And see, they have a special ability we don't. They have onboard sonar, biological sonar. And their sonar is extraordinary. Theirs makes Navy sonar still look primitive. And so they can see just as well in water at night as, you know, we can with our eyes, and
sure.
probably even a little bit better because they can see further with the sound.
Wow.
So that doesn't slow them down at all.
Yeah, yeah, but it's still, yeah, it's interesting that nonetheless that they wouldn't be doing something different, taking it easy, doing,
oh,
you know, whatever.
That's what I expected.
Yeah, yeah, wow. And so that's kind of surprising. What are three or four other notable or surprising things you've learned over the course of the study about, you know, bottlenose dolphins, that those of us who've...
Well, the big one was the birthing circles.
Yeah,
I actually sat on that for quite a few years because I only had a few photographs. They weren't very good.
Uh-huh.
I had a lot of sightings of it
yeah.
until a woman in Laguna called me and said, I have video of what you're talking about. And it was extraordinary. It was like a two-hour video taken with Beta from her cliffside vantage point,
Pre-Arch
Bay,
yeah.
Not one, but two birthing circles.
Wow.
And so then I would take that to my colleagues and show it to them and say, what do you think? And they'd
yeah.
say, publish your paper.
Yeah.
Because they knew I was working on a paper on this, but I was afraid to talk about it because it sort of sounds like UFO landings.
Right.
You don't have some good video.
To back it up, yeah.
The big thing this year was something that I never expected to happen. I got a call from a volunteer at Upper Newport Bay, Rita McCoy, and this was in July, and she said, Dennis... what are these dolphins doing in Upper Newport Bay? And I said, oh, Rita, that can't be. Dolphins don't live in Upper Newport Bay. In fact, they never visit there. You were looking at a seal. And she goes, well, these are seals with dorsal fins.
Yeah.
And she described where it was being seen. She said, we've seen these for several days. It's off a little place called Pearson's Port, which is a little, they sell fish there and things. It's a
mm-hmm.
floating dock facility right
yeah.
next to the Pacific Coast Highway Bridge. And I went down there, and sure enough, I got there, I walked down the dock, and there's a seal out in the middle of the bay. And I, oh, well, there's what Rita saw.
Yeah.
And then right near the seal, two dorsal fins came up.
Wow.
And here's these two dolphins. And I've subsequently gone back down there now 11 times. And up until recently, it was always two dolphins, and they were swimming around in this one little place feeding where a lot of fish congregate. And Mrs. Pearson, Vi Pearson, I
mm-hmm.
talked to her about it. She's the matriarch of the family. She
yeah.
said, I think they found the honeypot. They swam in here somehow, and they found out that this is a place where fish congregate.
Wow, we ain't leaving.
We ain't
yeah.
leaving. Yeah.
yeah.
And
yeah.
so this has been extraordinary. Now, unfortunately, it appears that one of the two died. And about 3 weeks ago, I got a call, and in Upper Newport Bay, they found a dolphin dead on a beach.
Yeah.
And quite decomposed. And so it was examined, and it did have some propeller cuts on it, but that doesn't mean it was hit by a boat. It made it. It could have mean anything, but it could
right.
have died and then been hit.
Sure.
The trouble is, it was so far decomposed that it was impossible to tell.
Right.
And then subsequently, we only saw one dolphin at that location.
So why, by inference, it was
yeah.
probably the other.
It was probably the other
one.
Dolphin.
Yeah.
And we did recover the body, and the body has been buried at Upper Newport Bay Ecological Reserve Marine Science Center. And eventually what we're going to do is pull the bones out when it's completely decomposed and hopefully make an exhibit about this, telling people the story of these two dolphins. And so that's one big thing that's
yeah.
not only happened, it's going on right now.
Because the other guy's still there, right?
The other guy's still there. I
yeah.
just saw him Monday, and
yeah.
he's swimming around.
Wow.
I'm taking a lot of video of him, and mainly what I've been doing is telling people now, just enjoy this. This is fun that he's there, but
mm-hmm.
don't try to grab hold of this dolphin or swim up to him. Or
feed him.
Or feed him.
Yeah.
Just leave
yeah.
him alone,
yeah.
and if he wants to, there's an old enough dolphin, he will leave, or she will leave if
mm-hmm.
she wants to. In fact,
yeah.
Mrs. Pearson and her daughter-in-law and her son have actually seen other dolphins in there, up to four or five dolphins at a time.
I mean, just over the years or recently?
Just recently.
Oh, really?
And they
wow.
all have said they've seen dolphins before in the past over the years, but not for a long time, not for days, just one day and then they were gone. This animal's been there since July, and you know now it's October and it's still there.
Yeah,
and there may be
maybe
some
words
other...
out, right? I mean, if the other ones are making it into
some other Pearson's dolphins may know. Yeah.
Some good eats.
We
yeah.
found the good place
for sure.
Now the other thing that happened that's just extraordinary is at our college, we have what's called a plastination lab, and a plastination lab is a very very advanced methodology where you can take actually any kind of organic specimen. It could be human, dolphin, whale, sea lion, bird, fish, and you remove the fluids from the animal and you replace them with polymers, and so you plastinate the animal. And the result of that is you have an animal that looks pretty much like it did when it died. It never smells, it never decays, it never rots, but it has the same texture and the same appearance. In fact, there's a beautiful exhibit at the California Science Center now about the human body that was set up by the guy that started this program.
Yeah.
Well, we have a plastination lab, and almost 5 years ago, I went to our anatomy physiology people that run the lab, and I said, if I can acquire a dead baby dolphin, one that dies of natural causes, could you guys plastinate it? And they said, by all means. Well, that was 5 years ago, and in that 5 years, I got a permit from the National Marine Fisheries Service to do this, and no baby dolphin showed up. And then literally, just since August, 4 baby dolphins fell in my lap.
Wow.
4 baby dolphins died in various places of natural cause. They were all in excellent condition.
Hmm.
And so we, I think, are going to be the first ever to plastinate a dolphin. And what you end up with is a full animal, full body animal, or you can do sagittal sections of it, you know, pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can examine its anatomy, and yet there's no formaldehyde, there's mm-hmm. no ickiness or anything
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
And the animal stays in pretty much perfect condition forever. And this is going to be extraordinary for our students. They're going to be
yeah.
some of the first students ever to be able to do this.
Wow.
In fact, some of the students are going to take part in the plastination project.
Yeah.
So it's literally been raining dolphins on me now for about 6 months.
And one thing you said along the way, though, that I just can't help but ask about is, why would a baby dolphin that you said is otherwise, you know, seem to be in good health, why would they die then as baby dolphins?
Well, one of the four dolphins that died was in the birth canal. And something
okay.
happened while the female was giving birth, and she came ashore, and the baby, and she died. But they recovered them instantly, and the baby was in perfect condition, was just dead.
Okay.
One came in with its mother, and the mother was injured, and the baby died subsequently on the beach. So
okay.
it can be
yeah.
things like that. They can get caught in nets.
Sure.
They sometimes, you know, panic.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're it sounds extraordinary, but sometimes they get separated from the mother,
right.
and they just go
don't
ashore.
Know what to do.
Yeah.
yeah.
And
yeah.
usually, you know, in the years that I tried to get one, usually I get a call from somebody saying, well, we have a baby dolphin. Okay, great. Where is it at? Well, we only have the head. The back part was run over by a truck on the beach. That's how we found it.
Mm.
And so until now,
yeah.
I didn't get any that were in perfect shape.
Yeah.
Now I did.
Yeah.
And so we're going to go ahead with this.
Wow. So, Dennis, we're probably just nearing about the end of our time, but just a few more things obviously we want to try to squeeze in before we do have to say goodbye here is what's ahead then for the project? It seems like it's been a kind of a really cool, constantly evolving, you know, sort of beast, you know, of one kind or another. And so are you already saying, hey, well, here's where we want to go with this over the next few years? Or are you starting to feel like, hey, you know, I've done this long enough, I might start to hang it up soon?
Well, I'm seriously looking for somebody that could take over the project
mm-hmm.
and run it, because I'm obviously not going to be there forever.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of students that are still interested in participating. And I've expanded the project. I've networked with colleagues both to the south, San Diego, that do dolphin
mm-hmm.
research, and to the north. And so what we try to do is put together a network of people studying these animals so we have a broader look at them. And basically the dolphins stretch now from as far north as Monterey Bay to as far south as below the border in Mexico. And there's even a Mexican team down in Ensenada studying parts of the population down there.
Wow.
And I'd like to see this continued. I'd like to see somebody, you know, continue this research. But as of right now, I don't know who that would be.
Right.
Maybe
right.
my replacement when I retire from Orange Coast College.
Yeah, yeah. And is that imminent, or have you not really made any decisions?
It's not imminent.
Good.
It's not imminent.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we like to hear. Excellent. Excellent. And, you know, as you mentioned to our caller, and just obviously from talking about the project, I mean, you know, the approach you've taken in researching dolphins is very hands-off, very non-invasive. So I'm curious about your thoughts on, you know, for example, dolphins in captivity, SeaWorld, other places, just your general view on that.
Well, I think that there's definitely a need for SeaWorld. For instance, when I actually ran the Orange County Stranding Network for marine mammals for a while, and when I found a dolphin live on the beach, I wanted there to be a SeaWorld for it to go to that was mm-hmm. ready to accept it to take care of it. In addition to that, there's literally hundreds of dolphins now and quite a few killer whales that have been born in captivity. And I don't really see how we could release them to the wild and give them a chance of survival, given the fact they've never lived in the wild. And so because SeaWorld's been around for a long time, because these animals are there, I think there needs to be a place where mm-hmm. they can live.
Yeah.
But I would feel terrible if one of the dolphins that I studied, I watched get captured and then end up at SeaWorld,
yeah.
because I know what their life's like in the wild. And when SeaWorld years ago, this is back in early 1980s, announced that they were going to capture killer whales off this coast, I was one of the people that came out against that. I said, mm-hmm. before you do any captures, let's find out how many killer whales are out there and stuff.
Sure.
And it turns out there's quite a few. I actually fostered some of the original research on killer whales off this coast. And today we know there's up to about 185 killer whales that utilize the Southern California coast.
Really?
And they live in pods or families. And these small families are long-term families that have been together their whole life. And I would just be appalled to think that one of those animals would be grabbed out of the wild and put in captivity.
Unless it
was injured or something like that, mm-hmm. and it couldn't live in the wild anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that's a past issue now, because SeaWorld has been very, very successful with their captive breeding, and they now have fairly large populations of captively bred animals, mm-hmm. and I think those animals have to have a place to live.
Right. I mean, they sort of created their own need for themselves in a sense, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, Dennis, well, I guess we are sort of nearing the very end, but so you've been at OCC for 30 years.
Yeah.
So I guess, I guess this job's going to work out. Seems like you might have some long-term
security. I think I'm
going to
stick with it, yeah. I think they're going to keep me.
So, really, what's the single best thing, then, about having worked there and or working with the dolphins? I mean, what's been your favorite thing out of all those?
I achieved things I never even imagined I would achieve. I had the opportunity to get into a PhD program after my master's degree, and I was studying sea urchin hybridization in Washington. And I am so glad I didn't do that. I'm so glad that I got to study dolphins, because they're extraordinary animals. I mean, to me, it's fulfilling a dream I had as a little kid. Mm-hmm. I watched Sputnik go over.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wondered, would we ever run into an intelligent, non-terrestrial beings? And we haven't up till today, that everybody agrees on, at least. But I'll tell you, dolphins are pretty intelligent, and they live right off our coast, and they're extraordinary animals. And to think that I could do this in my backyard, to this day, when I see them, it still gives me goosebumps.
Wow, that's so cool. Well, thanks again for coming in and talking to us about dolphins. I want to remind people, a couple websites, basically it's the same website, but the basic website for Dennis and related things is, again, www.dkat, the word at, antarctic.com. And then to find out more specifically about the dolphin, the survey project we were discussing for most of the interview, again, it's the same thing, www.dkatantarctic.com/coastaldolphinsurvey.html. So, Dennis, thanks again for joining us. And
thank you, Duncan.
It was really, really great, and really learned a lot of stuff. I still can't get over that birthing circle. That's fascinating, you know. So, cool. All right. Well, anyway, this is Talk Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. It's time for Name That Animal Tune, and we're in the home stretch here, and I think you know how it works. It's like any other version of Name That Tune, except it's animal-related. So, and the tunes are always, the winner of this always gets a prize. We talked about the prize early on in the show. So, first person who calls in correctly identifies this song. I think we've made it fairly easy today. We'll have a choice of those prizes, and the number again is 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. So, it's Name That Animal Tune on KUCI. Well, this sort of borders on who's buried in Grant's tomb, doesn't it? I mean, anyway, all right. Well, if you still think of it, or just get the nerve up to call, here, how obvious is this? They're singing the answer to the quiz question. Anyway, so I'm Duncan Strauss. We have reached the end of this week's edition of Talking Animals. I want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KUCI, UCI, the University of California Board of Regents. I want to thank again, I guess, Dennis Kelly. And it was really, really interesting. And again, various offshoots of the website, dk@antarctic.com. And check out more about what we talked about and a bunch of other cool stuff as well that we just didn't have time to chat about today. And thanks for the phone calls. And the next Monday, our guest will be Michael Hingson, who's now an official with Guide Dogs for the Blind, but was a sales executive working on the 78th floor of the World Trade Center on 9/11 and was led to safety by his guide dog, Roselle. So we have some pretty interesting things to talk about with him. That'll be next Monday, August 18th on Talking Animals. I hope you'll join us. By the way, other great public affairs shows on KUCI include just today alone the Serena Sharp Show, which of course precedes Talking Animals. Then at 5 p.m. we offer Planetary Radio with Matt Kaplan, followed at 5:30 by Counterspin. And that's just Monday, folks. There's great public affairs programming and talk shows like this virtually each weekday, 8 to 9 and 9 to 10 in the morning. Then again from 5 to 6 in the afternoon. Plus, I want to make a special note. This Thursday, 8 to 9 in the morning on Just Us, Ozo Motley, the great politically charged L.A.-based band, will discuss social activism, all kinds of aspects of the upcoming election, of course, music. They have a new album out and much, much more, including some arrests that they've undergone, various protests, including, I think, a few years ago at the Democratic Convention. Anyways, really, really interesting. So that's this Thursday, 8 to 9 a.m. on Just Us with Jarrett Lovell. On the music side of the KUCI schedule, I also host a show called The Dead Air Zone, which recently moved to Monday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. It's truly eclectic, from Afrobeat to Zydeco. Yes, that's A to Z. So when you have a chance some Monday night, please check it out. So it's I'll be back in a few hours for that. And again, I want to urge you to check out our website, talkinganimals.net. When you get there, please sign up for our email list so we can alert you to guest bookings and other events and announcements. I also encourage you to email me with comments, guest suggestions, ideas about show topics, songs, comedy bits, news stories, and anything else you'd like to pass along at talkinganimals@AOL.com. Really look forward to hearing from you. I really, really do. Please stay tuned for Jeff Scott and The Blues Disease is a great, great blues show here on KUCI. This has been Talking Animals on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And as always here, we're going to end things up with an animal song. It's brand new music from Elvis Costello with a song called Monkey to Man on KUCI. Catch you next week on Talking Animals.
A long time ago, our point of view was broadcast by Mr. Bartholomew. And now the world is full of sorrow.
Monkey to man,
monkey to man,
monkey to man,
monkey to man. forgiven his crimes. Fills up the air with his pride and